Welcome to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. In Chicago, I'm Steve Alexander, and for Orion Samuelson, our friend Max Armstrong will be along, coming up in a few minutes to talk about ag commodities. And Terry Duffy of the CME Group has an interview coming up about Bitcoin and the CME Group's plan to begin Bitcoin futures. Well, here we are a few days into November, and November has generally been a good month for the markets. We got out of October without any harm. Actually, October is known for some bad things happening, like the crash of 1987. But this time around, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 4.3%. November, which historically has been one of the best months of the year, also kicks off the strongest six-month stretch for stocks. Past performance suggests that the stock market, which has been climbing steadily this year, pushing the Dow to 54 record highs and up nearly 19% year-to-date, might enjoy a seasonal tailwind. Consider these statistics. In the past 20 years, the Dow has posted average gains of 1.9% in November, third best of all 12 months. In the current bull run that began in March of 2009, the broad S&P 500 index has gained 1.75% in November versus the average gain of 1.2% in November's since 1983. In years like 2017, when stocks have been up 10% plus through October, the S&P 500 averaged a November gain of 2.7%. It finished up 80% of the time. Still, with many questions surrounding potential changes to the tax code and stocks on their longest run without a 3% dip, some analysts are suggesting that there could be some overdue volatility. But let's see how we did this week. For the week, the S&P 500 was up 0.26%, the Dow was up 0.45%, and the NASDAQ was up 0.94%. The S&P 500 and the Dow have registered eight straight weeks of gains. The NASDAQ is in its sixth week in a row of gains. Apple juiced the market as Apple shares were up over 2.6% at the close, $172.50. Earlier on, Apple was up over 3%, and that took Apple's value over $900 billion for the first time. On Friday, the Dow gained 23 points, the S&P 500 gained 8, and the NASDAQ gained 49 points. Oil prices rose on Friday, nearing their highest levels in more than 2 years, supported by rising global demand and physical prices and continuing expectations that OPEC and other producing countries are going to extend a deal to cut output. The U.S. West Texas Intermediate futures settled at $55.64 a barrel, the highest level since 2015, up $1.10 per barrel. Texas tea is now 30% above its 2017 low, which was hit back in June. Gold slid lower on Friday after getting a little bit of a boost from worse-than-expected jobs numbers in October. Spot gold dropped 0.73% to $1,266.36 per ounce. It hit its highest in about 2 weeks in the afternoon at $1,284.10. Gold, of course, is highly sensitive to rising interest rates, and J.P. Morgan put out word Friday afternoon that it expects 4 interest rate increases in 2018. Turning to ag commodities, let's begin with soybeans, which were lower thanks to worries about Brazil. Brazil's currency weakened, and that made Brazil beans more attractive to big buyers such as China. January soybeans were down 12.5 cents at 9.86¾ a bushel, retreating from Thursday's 1.5 week high of $10.5 a cent. December corn was down 2.5 cents at 3.48 a bushel, and December wheat fell 2 cents at 4.24 a bushel. For the week, corn was down about a penny a bushel, and wheat was down about 4 cents, or 1%. Okay, let's do a little bit of a dive into Bitcoin, and a lot of talk around Bitcoin was generated by the CME Group announcing that it is launching sometime before the end of the year, Bitcoin Futures. A lot of people are curious about Bitcoin. Is it a legitimate asset, or just a super bubble of speculation waiting to implode? As prices for this cryptocurrency skyrocket, investors and pundits are increasingly taking sides. And whether you're a backer or a detractor, What's not in doubt is Bitcoin's dizzying rally this year. The most widely used digital currency crossed the $7,000 mark this week. It's up more than 650% in 2017. It has managed to whip past the $100 billion total value mark despite governmental crackdowns and mainstream market skepticism and the fact that it isn't really tied to anything in particular. With the rhetoric for and against heating up this week, here is a look at where some of the big names in finance stand. From those who see it as the natural evolution of money to the naysayers waiting for it to crash and burn. Among Bitcoin's backers is Bitcoin Jesus. That's a man named Roger Ver, V-E-R, who remains optimistic about Bitcoin's sustainability amid attempts from governments like China to curb some of the more speculative elements of trading. He said in a Bloomberg interview, the only way to stop Bitcoin is to turn off the entire internet in the entire world and keep it turned off. Some countries are jumping on the Bitcoin bandwagon. Argentina, one of the more prominent ones. Its most important futures market is considering offering services to investors in digital currencies, while the governor of the Turkish Central Bank looks at digital currencies as a path to financial stability if they are designed well. There are a lot of detractors, though, some big-name detractors. Let's begin with J.P. Morgan Chase and Company CEO Jamie Dimon, one of Wall Street's most strident Bitcoin opponents. He said in October that people who buy the currency are, quote, stupid, and that governments will eventually crush it. The CEO of Credit Suisse Group says Bitcoin and the speculation around it is the very definition of a bubble. He said the only reason to buy or sell Bitcoin is to make money, and such speculation has rarely led to a happy ending. The Themis Trading Company raised a red flag this week after the CME Group announced that it will introduce Bitcoin futures. It said the world's largest exchange owner appeared to have caved in to pressure from clients. Themis says CME is placing a seal of approval around a very risky, unregulated instrument that has a history of fraud and manipulation. Well, the CME Group's chairman and CEO Terry Duffy responded to those challenges and other questions in an interview with Bloomberg Television.
In a change of policy, the world's biggest exchange owner announced it plans to introduce Bitcoin futures by year end. The cryptocurrency jumped on the news, reaching an all-time high of more than $6,400. Let's bring in CME chairman and CEO Terry Duffy now to discuss. And Terry, this is huge news because for so many people who are enamored by Bitcoin and want to trade it, this seems like the biggest institutional endorsement of Bitcoin that we've seen yet. Not so long ago, though, you were kind of cautious on Bitcoin derivatives. So for a lot of people, it can seem like a 180. What changed? What made you decide to launch these futures products?
Well, Scarlett, first, thanks for having me on. And this is kind of trivial news compared to what you just reported on earlier, what's going on in Lower Manhattan. So our thoughts and prayers go out to all those that are affected by another senseless act that happened. So that being said, I'll pursue with your question. And, you know, first of all, CME Group is always looking to bring new products to the marketplace. And we have seen a pent-up demand by clients for, you know, quite some time now, Scarlett. And this is a story that just hasn't gone away. So constantly getting calls from clients about how we're going to list this product. And, you know, I was not as excited about the product, to your point earlier. But then when you look at the way our model works and what we can apply to that to this product, I think it's a lot different than some of the naysayers that are talking about cryptocurrencies and the way they trade today, who trades them, what they're being used for. So ours will be on a regulated platform overseen by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. It will be under our risk controls that we have in place here at CME. So we have our margin rules in place. We'll have our functionality with our electronic systems in place. And then, of course, our clearing mechanism. Those are all things that are completely different than the way the cryptos are traded today. And we will have an index that, you know, we feel that will be very, very credible and will reflect the true value of that price. So that's why we're excited about this product and the launch of it.
Terry, one thing that makes Bitcoin unique is that what we call Bitcoin today may not be Bitcoin tomorrow. There are forks, there are spin-offs, all kinds of things you don't get with a typical, say, commodity or currency like gold or the yen. Have you figured out how you're going to work through these things should more forks occur in the future?
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. So there's a meeting coming up in the coming weeks, as you're aware, Joe, and we are going to see how one of those forks comes into play, and then we may have to make a couple different contract spec design changes. But that's one of the things that we do really well here is we can go ahead and make the contract spec changes. And one of the other things, Joe, that I think is really important when it comes to this contract, traditional futures contracts normally trade out over a curve. I think when you look at this particular product, you're going to see most of the trade up front, so you won't have the problem of making contract spec changes because you won't have open interest in the deferred months going out. So example being our Eurodollar contract, you have open interest going out 10 years and 40 quarters. I don't see that being the same nuance with this particular product.
Terry, another factor is it's clear that a lot of people want to invest in Bitcoin or they want to speculate or trade Bitcoin. But what about the other side, the hedgers, the people? Who do you see is playing that role for economic reasons in your market?
You know, it's really interesting because, first of all, we have 1,146 currencies in the world today that are all, you know, doing a whole host of different things. But you look at just certain companies looking to create potentially their own currencies for their own particular products. Maybe Starbucks comes up with a Starbucks currency because that will help increase their business. So I think the institutional side, people will be looking at ways to make more efficiency of their payment methods. And if they see Bitcoin as a way to do it, that's it. There's other people that own the product today. They would be the natural, the short sellers of this. And there's other people that will be on the long side because they think the valuation is too cheap or they'll think it's too high, but this will give people the ability to participate in a product on a regulated platform that they have not had that opportunity to do for to date.
Terry, Jamie Dimon quite famously called Bitcoin a fraud here, and you've sort of alluded to your own perhaps concerns about this in the past. Do you see this as legitimizing the trading of cryptocurrencies in some way, legitimizing Bitcoin?
You know, I'm not quite sure, you know, when Jamie's referring to it as a fraud or the tulips crisis, what he referred to it as. You know, as I said at the beginning of my comments here, I think that is in the way the market is looked at today and who was using it and why they were using it. That's not the purpose that we're looking to use it for tomorrow. When you're on a highly regulated platform, you have to come through one of our FCMs. There's a whole host of other mechanisms and procedures and protocols and regulations to trade our marketplace versus the people that are using it today in the cash market. So, again, I think Jamie's comments, and I didn't speak to Jamie about this, were more referring to those different participants. So when you look at the model that we're going to apply to it, I think it's a bit different.
Terry, but just going back, so if this takes off and there are more futures and maybe an ETF at some point, this will create a lot of liquidity in the market. But the uses of Bitcoin are largely about subverting or doing payments that the government doesn't want us to do or regulators don't want us to do and all sorts like that. Are you concerned about the fact that an established financial institution will bring liquidity to a market whose main purpose is to subvert the existing financial system?
Well, first of all, I would never be part of anything that subverts the government and the financial system. So that's not what we're trying to do here. We're going to bring transparency to this marketplace, and we'll also have the audit function associated with this marketplace. So anybody that's participating in the Bitcoin trading of CME will have an instant audit trail to the government regulator to make sure that the things that you just outlined do not happen. That's what the difference is in our offering versus the way it is today. So they can't circumvent those procedures that you referred to with the government under our model.
Terry, you talked about when you began this pent-up demand for this product that you're catering to. Can you give us any sense of just what that pent-up demand looks like and the kind of volumes of trading that you're expecting once this product's up and running?
It's really hard to predict what the volumes are going to be. You know, I get a lot of calls from clients on both sides of the trade, and they're looking for this particular product to be launched out there. But you got to remember, this is a $100 billion market. This is not a multi-trillion dollar market like the foreign exchange or other markets. So it's a smaller market in general. So we're going to have to wait and see how people want to participate into it. So like any other futures contract, you're going to need, you know, people on both the natural longs and natural shorts, and you're going to need the speculators to make it successful. But what that translates into volumes is I'm not going to predict at all.
Terry, final question to you. Timing-wise, Julia almost sang a song. It is Bitcoin's ninth birthday. Bitcoin trading at a record high. It reached $6,416. There's a lot of concern that it's in a bubble. Cryptocurrencies in general are in a bubble. Do you see any sign of that at all? What gives you pause here when you look at the price?
And nothing gives me pause when I look at prices, Scarlett. I think that's really what we're supposed to do here is manage risk. We're not supposed to decide what the price of any particular product is. So I've seen a lot of different bubbles over the last 37 years as I've been in this business, but it's not up for me to predict if it's a bubble or not. So you could talk about the housing bubble. You could talk about the tech bubble. You could talk about a whole host of things. What I'm here to do is to help people manage risk, and we're to do it in the most effective way under a regulated platform. So whether crude oil was at $137 a barrel going to $26, or cryptocurrencies are trading at $6,400, $6,400. That's not for me to make that decision of what the valuation is. We're here to manage at risk. Yeah.
Terry,
the level doesn't matter.
Real quickly, we just have a couple of seconds. Can you tell us what the size of a contract, the leverage limits, and the volatility limits will be?
Yeah, again, we have not put out those details as of yet. We're working with our regulator to finalize all those details, which we'll have out relatively shortly. So I'm not prepared to give you those right now.
CME Group Chairman and CEO Terry Duffy. One of the higher-profile skeptics of Bitcoin is Lloyd Blankfein, the chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs. He also spoke with Bloomberg TV.
Look, I have a level of discomfort with it, as I have a level of discomfort with anything that's new. But I've learned over the years that there's a lot of things that work out pretty well that I don't love. I remember when they first came out with cell phones. I'm thinking, why would anybody want this thing? It lasts, you know, battery lasts about 10 minutes. It weighs a ton. You have to have it on your back. And there's phone machines every 15 feet. Why would anyone want this? Guess what? I missed that one. And here, I read a lot of history, and I know once upon a time, a coin was worth $5 if it had $5 worth of gold in it. And then a piece of paper was worth $5, but only if it was backed by gold in the treasury or silver in the silver certificate. And even then, people were suspicious. Now we have paper that's only backed by fiat. The government says, I think that's what it's worth. Maybe in the new world, something gets backed by consensus. Right. Instead of a government fiat, maybe it's a consensual arrangement by people that agree that it's worth something, kind of like what social media does. It's not my natural state of comfort. But if you told me that, you know, if we went into the future and Bitcoins were successful, I would be able to explain how it's a natural evolution from hard money. By the way, why is gold worth anything more than the jewelry value in gold? That's kind of a consensus that people have. Because no government says, I'm going to pay you $1,300 an ounce from gold. It just is that. If somebody, why is it worth that? You can't eat it. Why is it worth that? Because it's been like that for a long time. And so maybe 200 years from now, even someone like me might be comfortable with it. But right now, I tell you, I don't have an investment in it, but I'm not willing to poo-poo it, and that's why I say I'm open to it.
Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, talking about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. Coming up, Max Armstrong and a guest talk about something much more tangible than cryptocurrencies, agriculture commodities, right after this.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
To talk about the market situation this weekend, Jim McCormick joined us from Allendale Incorporated. Jim, how have you been?
I've been very good. Thank you for having me on, Max.
This is an interesting autumn, isn't it? It's a little bit quieter, I suppose, around your office, is it not?
It is very, very quiet. I mean, for the last 60 days, it seems like this market has just gone dead. And, you know, that's kind of made it a little bit different compared to, you know, the last 5-10 years when the funds are really pushing this market around. A lot of customers are really complaining, man, these funds are really pushing the market. Now we're asking them, hey, where are you at? Come back in.
They do bring that element into the market. I mean, we hate it when they run the prices down, but their presence in the market can really provide the volatility that producers can capitalize upon, correct?
Yeah, we need that volatility, and the fact is we need that excitement to come back into the market. They're the ones that push us to the – they'll bring us to the extreme, to the downside, where the customers are not happy or the producers are not happy, but the end users are really taking advantage of. But they'll be the also ones that will push us back up maybe to 4, 450 this summer if you can give them a reason to get excited, plain and simple.
Does it also hurt a little bit that the equity market is doing so well? I mean, that gives these folks an opportunity to put their money into something that is performing at the moment.
Oh, I think that's probably what we're seeing right now. You're seeing your traditional fund traders. They're sticking in the eggs, but you're seeing the money. If you want to buy something, you want to buy corn that's been trading at 350 now for 60 days, or you want to buy the stock market that's making, you know, just incredibly new highs. We got this tax proposal coming on here this week, and you know, that if that gets passed, it's probably going to accelerate the gains even more. So that's where the excitement is, and the money tends to go where it's excited.
How's this harvest going from your standpoint? There are some places in the Corn Belt where it's been very slow, well behind normal.
It is definitely a slower than normal pace for harvest. I don't think it's really having a huge impact in the market per se. We've had such a huge carry-in right now. There was no shortage, so it's a grind. Some of it is helping out the dryer capacity. I know the corn's coming a little bit wet, so maybe slowing down a little bit is, you know, as these dryers try to keep up pace, but it'll get in. I mean, that's the one thing in my career I found. We always like to hype. We'll never get it planted. We like to hype. It's never going to get harvested, and we've got some big equipment, some very good farmers in the United States, and we always get it done.
Isn't that the truth? I mean, I've commented the same thing many times, that for all of the hand-wringing over the planting season and for individual farmers, it can be gut-wrenching hand-wringing because they're worried about getting it in and getting a good stand, and you don't have a crop unless you get it planted. But we always get it planted, and somehow those acres always come in out of the field. Again, the individual farmer may worry about that downed corn and the possibility that it's going to be difficult to pick up. And I've heard that there have been some reels going out into the countryside in places like Michigan, for example, where they've had to worry about picking that corn up. But still, somehow, we get it in. And it's going to be big.
And it's going to be big. And, yes, there are going to be some producers. I have some customers out in, like, western Nebraska. They're talking about some lost bushels to the ground, fall corn on the ground. But, you know, as a big percentage, we've got a monster crop coming on us. And the fact is, if we lose a few 100,000 bushels due to down corn, if you're that producer, it really stinks. But for the nation as a whole, it's a drop in the bucket, plain and simple.
My friend Fred from Iroquois County posted a picture this week on Facebook, and he showed some construction equipment moving down the road. He said they're getting ready to pile and sling corn. And I guess I hadn't thought about that phrase before, corn slinging, but at some of the elevators, indeed, they're getting ready to put it out there on the ground, which happens nearly every year, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you'll see a piles. It's a big, you know, a lot of people talk about it. They get, you know, it's interesting to see. You see these huge piles. It's, I mean, I saw a picture one time of a guy skiing down the pile of corn one time. But it's a normal, you know, it's normal. We see it. That'll be the first thing that goes, and it'll get picked up, and we'll get it consumed. Always do.
We've seen pictures of guys skiing down between the rows at planting time, too, you
yes.
know, when they're waiting to get into the field in some instances. We have a crop report coming up in the week ahead. Thursday, USDA will release its November numbers, and I guess that'll be the actual last report ahead of the final numbers in January. What are you expecting to see? I mean, I'm seeing a corn number that's climbing higher in private estimates.
I think that's what we're going to see. I mean, I think as we start getting these estimates out, you're looking for 1 to 1.5 to maybe 2 bushels higher. It is going to be there. It looks like throughout the harvest, it's been pretty much amazing. I mean, talking to customers in Indiana, you know, they planted this crop once, twice, in some cases 3 times, yeah. And they're still pulling 200-plus bushel of corn out. You ask them where it comes from, and like, I have no idea, Jim. It's there. I think the USDA has Indiana at 173 national yield last month. That matches last year. So I would expect the corn crop to get a little bit bigger. The beans, on the other hand, they seem to be like the later beans. Maybe this dryness we saw in the last 6 weeks of the yield of production cycle might have took some of the very top end off of these later beans. So I think the trade's looking for the bean yield to be down a little bit. And that's also what's kind of propelling the beans up the last couple of weeks. I think the market's bracing and trying to buy into what's anticipated to be a slightly friendly number.
If that number doesn't slip, it could be bearish then for the bean market.
I would definitely believe so. I mean, we need a bullish number. The market's priced in. The trend's up. We've held the uptrend line to 200-day multiple times this past week. If we get a bearish number, don't be surprised to see this market unfortunately go rotate right back down and maybe test the October lows.
If indeed they do trim that number, it would be a very prominent reminder, would it not, of how much those days in August mean to a soybean crop with the kind of drier weather that we experienced.
Well, yeah, I definitely would agree with that. I mean, the old line is, you know, beans are made in August. And, you know, we had some of the driest weathers. It's pretty amazing. We went from flooding rains in northern Illinois in, you know, middle of July to just absolutely bone dry weather in late August. And, you know, it shows that how critical that rain is. And that'll just reemphasize what happens as we go into 2018. If we have a late dry summer from La Nina or something, that'll draw the trade's attention and get some of that excitement we're looking for.
We are seeing the planting of the crop in Brazil, and it appears that that's right about on schedule, isn't it? I mean, there was early concern about dryness, but when you look at all of the acreage down there, it seems to be very close to the average pace.
They're right, exactly. They're pretty much right where they should be. I mean, in general, the Brazilian farmers, like the American farmer, they run big equipment, and they can get it in once the weather turns, and it turned. They got the moisture they wanted, and now they're planting. So right now, they're getting it in. Now we'll see what La Nina does. If it continues to build like a lot of these forecasters are projecting, that should give us some rainy problems potentially in like Argentina, and maybe that'll get the market a little bit excited.
With the acreage so spread out in South America, it makes it difficult, doesn't it, for a weather problem to really ignite the market anymore? I mean, it's got to be a very prominent, widespread one, and that's hard when you consider the longitude that is covered in the production of crops down there.
Yes, I would agree. I mean, the one thing, when I talk about a weather problem excited, you might get a 30, 40, 50-cent move. I tell producers, you need to take advantage of it because exactly, think about what the weather we went through this year. We had, I mean, there are a lot of people who were thinking all year long, these bean yields are going to be down. You know, the July WASDE, the August WASDE, the government surprised us by raising the yields. And as one person pointed out, you know, pretty much they plant the same seed down in South America as they do up here. So, you know, it's pretty amazing what the technology is able to handle seed-wise.
And let the record show, they have the same technology in the cabs and with their equipment. They're quite advanced down there.
Yes, they are down there. So, I mean, the world right now, we need to see demand. China's demand continues to increase, and that's going to be the key, I think, overall to production agriculture right now is keeping that demand base strong.
There aren't any signs that that is going to weaken, are there? I mean, we have to really watch that and keep our fingers crossed because that is so crucial. That Chinese demand means all the difference of night and day to what happens to our soybean producers.
Well, exactly. Right now, that Chinese demand it's been strong. Every year we've had a history, the government's underestimating the demand. It seems to be bigger than we anticipate. Probably the biggest problem we have I'm looking at from my customers and telling them is, the political ramifications. The president's going over in Asia. He's kind of waffled back and forth on being tough on China, currency manipulator, you know, slapping tariffs on them. Same thing with Mexico and NAFTA. And, you know, something we got to be a little bit leery about is a good example is what happened 30 years ago. 30 years ago, Jimmy Carter we did the embargo on Russian wheat. We quit selling Russian the wheat. And look what happened. It took a while, dang near 30 years, but now Russia is planting all this wheat, and we're actually competing with them and losing market share to the Russians in the wheat market 30 years later. So, I mean, these political, if something would go wrong politically, and you encourage the Chinese to buy even more beans, let's say, from South America, that would definitely be a detriment. So that's something the producers need to keep an eye on out of Washington.
Your example is a good one. And if we go back 40 years, it was embargoes at that time relative to the grain market and Japan, relative to making sure we had plenty of grain available, that forced the Japanese to invest heavily in South America. And look at the monster created there.
Yes. So, I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, a little push here could have a huge impact 10, 20, 30 years down the line that we just don't know. So we want to see these trade deals come through. That is going to be very good for American agriculture if we can do it. If you look back historically, Max, almost every trade deal we've done in the last 30 years, American agriculture has really taking advantage of it, plain and simple.
Jim, it's good to have you in the studio. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Jim McCormick from Allendale and Incorporated.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need. Today, and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
As we wrap up this week's The Markets Show, sponsored by the CME Group, let's see how we did. The Dow for the week was up 0.45%, the S&P 500 was up 0.26%, and the NASDAQ was up 0.94%. The S&P and the Dow had 8 straight weeks of gains. The NASDAQ had its 6th straight week of gains. At the Chicago Board of Trade, wheat was off a quarter of a cent at $4.26 a bushel. December corn fell 2.25 cents at $3.48 a bushel. And November beans took a big hit because of the Brazilian currency. down 12 cents at $9.77 a bushel. Beef was higher. Pork was lower at the mark. Live cattle up $2.98 at $127.30 a hundred. October feeder cattle rose $2.95 at $160.87 a hundred. A lot of short covering and some fund buying going on there. And December lean hogs lost 70 cents at $65.80 a hundred. That's the markets for this week, sponsored by the CME Group. In for Orion Samuelson, and my thanks to Max Armstrong. I'm Steve Alexander.